Welcome to the Roleplay Initiative Podcast, the only advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Podcast, the superior edition.
Roleplay Initiative Podcast, volume number 3, issue 109. If we were in Texas right now, we'd be roasting at 109 degrees, but you know, so you're listening to the show. Ha. Anyway, DM thinks you're sitting alongside DM Matt.
Hello, everyone.
DM Nick.
Hi-de-ho, neighbor.
Thank you, Flanders. And guest starring today, sitting in is guest, we call him guest DM, co-host DM, DM Jim Wampler. Anyone know who he is?
Yeah. Greetings, this Jim guy. Why is he on our show?
How you doing, Jim?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Awesome. Why don't you tell a little few people out there, if they're not familiar, who you are, who you are.
I'm just some goon with a webcomic. No.
Okay, great.
No. My name's Jim Wampler. I'm an art director and a partner in TSR Games, an art director for Gygax Magazine. I do the online webcomic Marvin the Mage, which also appears in Gygax Magazine. I briefly, in the, around 2005-06, had a small press game publishing company that published Metamorphosis Alpha 4th Edition and a science fiction miniatures game I wrote called Galacta 3. And I play right now in Tim Kask's OD&D campaign, and I just got my butt in a brand new Dungeon Crawl Classics RPG campaign.
Yeah. Oh, the one out at Gateway Games?
Yeah.
Okay, I know.
Aren't you involved in that, Matt?
No, I'm not.
Maybe you should.
I have been to Gateway before to play HeroClix, so I know where it is. I'm like in the middle between a Yada Quest and a Gateway. In the Blue Ash area, Cincinnati. So I know the game stores well. I frequent them all.
Lucky. I wish I was down that way.
Yeah.
All right. So let's just head over to some news for tonight. Some interesting news. Obviously, as of now, the Unearthed Arcana reprint is now out on the shelves.
Huzzah. I can't wait.
Where I'm not positive, I haven't looked at it myself because I already have one, but there is no actual errata in it except for a page that's stuck on the someone told me near the back where a picture should be.
Yeah, I heard about that too. There was in the original Unearthed Arcana, there's the section that divides between the player section and the DM section. There was some art that was originally there. What they did, I guess, is that page, that's where they inserted the errata. So, and that was the errata, I guess it was originally in Dragon Magazine.
I'm just looking forward to owning a copy that doesn't fall apart when I read it.
Me too, Jim. You got
Mine's in perfect condition.
No, we talked about that before. It seems to be one of those things with that book, depending on which, I guess, production run you got of the Unearthed Arcana. Because I know I bought mine like when it first came out. I know for a fact. I know which convention, what year, and everything, which is really sad.
What shirt I wore, what pants. Oh, sorry.
I remember it was 1985. It was at OmaCon in Omaha, Nebraska, where I grew up. And I was like, I had to get that book in my hot little hands. Yeah, it's like mine's like barely holding together anymore. It's the gluing. I don't know what it is, but some people lucked out. Some people are like it failed its save. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm looking at mine right now. It has some wear, but it's still holding.
Yeah, mine's holding too. I bought mine off Amazon a few years ago for like $4. So.
Oh, well, you didn't have the original.
No, no, I don't have it. No. Really, the only books I've bought new in the store were second edition. My second edition Player's Handbook, DMG, and Monster Manual. Everything else I picked up secondary market.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't... Yeah. Actually, most of my RPG stuff I bought used. I very rarely rush out and buy something when it's first released.
That could be like a... That could be like a segment, the Frugal Gamer.
Yeah, that would be me. I live at Half Price Books.
Oh, Half Price Books is the bomb.
Oh yeah.
That's where I found my. For both of my girls, I found the reprint Player's Handbooks. You know, the 83 cover Player's Handbooks. I each found them a copy. It was like $325 each. You know, I was like, awesome.
Right. Yeah. It's like right now I'm eyeing a bunch of Judges Guild stuff at the one in Mason. They stuffed it in the collectible section, and with all the magazines and stuff. So if you didn't know the look for them there, you would never find them. But the price is a little high, so I'm waiting for them to mark them down a little bit. Then I'll just swoop in and buy them all.
If you can find the module Dark Tower, get it.
Okay.
That's the one I know from Judges Guild that is like the one you want to get.
Yeah.
Speaking of Gateway Games, he's got City State of the Invincible Overlord sitting over there for $40, and I just ain't got it. But it teases me every time. It taunts me every time I go to the store.
Yeah, I've seen that too. I have the 86 box set, or the 87 box set that Mayfair put out with the foreword by Gary. So, whereas the one he has is like the first printing. At Gateway, so I like my box set version because it has all kinds of cute little handouts and maps and whatnot.
I heard that thing is so amazing. I mean, you could just do a whole campaign just in that one city.
Yeah, you totally could. They statted out every building in the city complete with description and the NPCs that run the shop or own it and. Yeah. All the backstory of it's awesome.
Yeah, I'm kicking myself in the butt for not getting it back in the day when it was released.
Plus, the map is huge.
Yeah. Yeah, and it comes with two maps. It actually comes with a map for the DM that's labeled, and then another one for the players that you can let them write on if they want. So you can just hand them, here's a map of the city a merchant sold you. But now you kind of have to fill in what you want to mark off on it.
Huh. That's actually a novel idea.
Yeah. It also came with, like, guidebooks, too, like a visitor guide as well for the different classes. I actually used that in my current first edition campaign. I started them off in that city. I'm like, you come to the city, and there's a tourist booth, and they hand you these. And it was
basically Ed Greenwood ripped off City Invincible Overlord with his guidebooks.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah, because this.
Sorry, Ed.
Yeah, it told you who, like, where the guilds were. It told you where the inns and shops were, and every class had different information as well, like where the arena was for the fighters, where the temples were for the clerics, where the libraries and sages were for the magic users.
So it was like those Volos guidebooks before there was Volos guidebooks.
Yeah. It was
awesome.
Yeah.
I guess that's not to be confused with the Invincible Overlord box sets that they came out with later on, right?
Those actually, the City State of the Invincible Overlord box set was the main set. Those were expansions off of it.
Oh, it was? Okay. Yeah. You first. 1, 2, 3, 5, I could see on my shelf.
Yeah. Because I have Briarwood Castle, which is the main castle in the city of State of the Invincible Overlord. I have that, and I have the other haunted one, which I don't recall exactly what it was off the top of my head.
Betrayal of Bogwood, I can see off the side of the. Yeah, it's hard to see the things across the room. But anyway. Get to your local gaming shop and buy the Unearthed Arcana book and help support your local friendly gamer shop, or go to Amazon and buy it off Amazon. Just buy it. Show Wizards of the Coast that we want more books.
Right.
More reprints are on the way, but we want to tell them that we are here, we are loud, and we are proud.
Yeah, I guess next is the S series. It's going to be coming out.
Flavor Lord series, yeah. And as we heard, remember that when we were questioning, Nick, what it was on the series? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know the A series and S series is going to be coming out.
Well, we were questioning one of the modules because we never heard of it. They're actually putting a brand new one in there as well.
Yeah, A0.
Oh, they are for A0. Okay.
Yeah.
So they have like an intro, like a kickoff kind of to the whole Slave Lords
thing? I think so, yeah. There wasn't much details released about it as far as I was reading. But
God, that makes me think there's some game designer in the bowels of WotC who's only ever played AD&D, and they came to him and said, hey, we need an AD&D module in 2012. Plunk.
It's funny. There only is one person at WotC that plays AD&D. And remember when they used to have the DM hotline a couple years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I actually called it to find out, and there was one person named Todd who was the only person there at Wizards of the Coast that knew what first edition D&D was like.
I just have this picture of this old grognard sitting down there going, kid, I got dice older than you.
Yes.
Or he's that guy that they sent down to the basement with a flashlight and a can of Raid. I don't know.
To find his steepler?
My swing line steepler. Find my first character class that I played with a paladin.
So do we have any more news that we need to talk about?
I have some.
Oh, okay.
It's sad news, but as we're recording this today, Ernie Gygax's house burnt down to the ground. But I guess by the time the show comes out, that'll be old news to the listeners. But the good news is Ernie and his roommate and the dog all got out safe, but just with the clothes on their back. So they Ernie actually lost every possession, game collection, module note.
Gosh.
Everything. As we're recording this, that all just happened. The guys at Gygax Magazine were rallying around him, and I think Tim Kask is going to be the lead. So by the time this episode airs, anybody that wants to participate in helping Ernie out or get back on his feet in any way possible, I was instructed just to direct everybody to Tim Kask's Facebook page. He's going to take the lead on the efforts.
Okay, Matt, just put a link in his page if you can later on.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes to Tim Kask's Facebook page, and if there's any updates, I'll throw those in as well by the time this is released.
Yeah, hopefully we can, as a community, pitch in and help Ernie out. He's a good guy, so. Anyway, I guess, let's talk about some gaming.
Yeah.
So, Nick, how's your games been going?
Actually, haven't done anything of recently. I'm hoping actually this coming Friday I'll have my game with my regular group. So that's the one where, you know, last time they played Temple of Elemental Evil pretty much ended because they broke the dungeon literally. So I don't want to get into that again because I'm going to get a headache before I go to bed. So I'm taking a break from DMing that group, and my friend Jeff's going to take over, and we are going to go into an ongoing campaign that we had before, the quest for Bob. So we're going to go back and we're going to try to find Bob. Long story behind it, but it's going to be fun. It's kind of like we're doing some Spelljammer stuff. So we're like in the Spelljammer.
I love Spelljammer.
Yeah. So yeah, we have this, like, there's the guy who's, the guy who's actually the in charge of the helm. He's, like, really old and senile.
Yeah.
So he tends to forget who we are, let alone where we're going. So, but I'm looking for that. That'll be fun. And I think the week after that, which will be the first weekend of March, that first Saturday, I'm going to get back to doing DMing a Temple of Elemental Evil for the kids group. So looking forward to that one.
Oh, cool. What about you, Matt?
Well, last week, me and my group, we played in the first edition Ravenloft game I'm running. Right now, the players, they started off in this village, and they're just trying to find their way home. They got sucked into the mist, went out at sea, and then got stuck on this island, and so they were traveling around the island, and they left this one city, and they came across, ran into a priest from that city that they knew, and he told them that horrible things had just happened there, and an undead legion just slaughtered the entire city. So the players decided to go back to the city and see if they could help any survivors, and they ended up sneaking into the mansion of the guys that the I can't remember the French name that from the module that they have, because I'm running the living, I know the Walking Dead module for them. And they, so they snuck into the manor of Jean de Tarson. Yeah. And yes. Yeah. So, and, and then
be
that,
gone before I taunt you a second time.
Yes. So they snuck into there, had to lure some ghouls that were wandering in it outside, and they went and they ended up finding the tomb where Marcel, the one who caused all this problem, was, and they managed to slay him, and then they. Then the few zombies that were roaming the tomb with him collapsed once he fell, and all was well with the world. And they so they leave his manor, and then they look, and they just see giant walls of zombies approaching them. And that's where we left off.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so,
like an episode of The Walking Dead.
Yeah, pretty much, which is just hilarious because I hate The Walking Dead. I hate the show. I couldn't stand it after one. At the first episode, I was done with it. I'm like, I couldn't. I hated every character on it.
Well, we okay then.
Yeah. Yes. Yet I'm running a zombies in my own D&D game, so I'm some sort of masochist. But so yeah, we left off there, and then they'll be traveling to another domain after that they get through with if they survive the massive zombie wall. So yeah, that's what I've been up to.
I think the next Marvin the Mage should have a zombie attacking Matt. Jim, what do you think?
It could be arranged.
And have maybe like Rick Grimes in the background shooting him. Just a Walking Dead little thing going on there.
I'm sure I could think of something.
I like that show.
I love Walking Dead, so.
I just found all the main characters so annoying. I'm like, you people don't – and like not willing to do what it took to preserve their own survival. There was lots of acting appropriately stupid just to further the plot. I'm just – I couldn't – I'm like, I hate you all. I hope you die.
Well, most of them did, so don't worry.
Yeah.
Yeah. People die. Characters die in that. Hey. Yeah.
Nobody's safe.
No.
Well, maybe Rick for a while.
Yeah. For a while. I don't know. He's gone bonkers.
Yeah, that's true.
I saw that episode. I'm like, what?
No, he's losing it. He's losing it. So, you know, that's what happens in those type of situations.
Yep. Pressure's getting to him.
All right. Well, this is not the Walking Dead podcast, so let's continue on. So I'll go on my game. I'm going to be starting up a game as of when this comes out or have already started. It's a first edition game, and it's going to be called The Tyranny of Asmodeus.
Ooh.
It's branching off the game that I originally started, the Book of Sorrows. Well, I just decided that since we never continued that group failed, Asmodeus obtained the Book of Sorrows and took over the world and locked all the other gods out of connection to the world as we know it. And now there's this whole, like, he rules the world with an iron fist, and the players have to go around finding these beacons that he uses to control the world and destroy them.
Nice.
That sounds pretty cool.
I love it. It almost sounds like my Dark World campaign, man. Mm-hmm. It was like they're the last bastion of good, aren't they?
Yep, they're the resistance. There's only a small number of them, and there's demons roaming around everywhere. I even did like a campaign teaser video for it, which I'll throw in the window. And Matt, you can throw it in the notes for everybody to watch.
Yep.
Okay. I give it to credit to Glenn Hallstrom for doing the voiceover from Save or Die.
Oh, he's got a great voice.
Yeah, for voiceovers, he's great.
Well, zombies don't appear in Marvin the Mage, but Asmodeus is a character in the strip. And in Marvin the Mage, he's portrayed by Michael Dorn.
Oh, God.
Because that's just my picture with the little, you know, the Klingon mustache.
That's awesome. Well, he could take over, too. Awesome. Well, what about your game with Tim Cass that you're playing? And tell us a little bit about that.
Tim's campaign is on hiatus right now, and he's just gotten really, really busy. And a few months ago, we had a couple of problematic players, and we basically put the campaign on hiatus to ditch the players. And I've been hounding him ever since to start it back up, but he's leading a busy life right now. So I didn't get a chance to sling dice for a few months, and that's why I am so excited about this new Dungeon Crawl Classics campaign starting at one of our local game stores, because I'm an evangelist for that game. I love that game to death because it's like an alternate universe AD&D. And AD&D is the game I grew up on. It's like somebody took basic D&D and gave it a triple helping of Appendix N stuff.
Yeah, and, I have a copy of it, and I looked through it, and I'm like, wow, there's some really amazing stuff there. The folks at Goodman Games did a fantastic job.
Well, the game has race as class, but they fixed it, where every single race is fun to play now. The dwarves kick ass, the halflings, you have to have a halfling. We were all rolling characters going, somebody come up with a halfling, please, we need one. But I've played a lot of one-offs because one of the playtesters for Goodman Games is here in town, Rick Hullback. I could never get him to start a campaign, and this guy that's running the campaign started us off with the character funnel, which is a system in the game where you all start off, each player rolls up as many as you want. We, six players, we rolled three level zero peasants, and you get your peasant profession and your peasant possessions, and you go to your first dungeon with your pitchforks and your rolling pins. And so there's like 18 level zero characters. In the first game, we got in the keep and to the door getting ready to go downstairs, and out of 18 of us, about half had one hit point.
Ooh,
nice.
So I'm hoping there's some NPCs down in there to rescue that will turn into my next player character after mine all die.
Okay. Sounds cool.
It's fun. It's unbelievably fun.
Yeah, I like the character funnel concept. I was reading through that in the book, and I'm like, you know, that's an interesting take on everything, because, you know, you want this guy, whoever it is, he's the sole survivor. So he's the tough little scrapper. He's the one who's going to be whatever.
The occupations were hilarious because we just rolled them randomly. And one of my guys came up, he was a gong farmer, and his equipment was a bag of night soil. And the guy game mastering is 28. And he looked at me and he goes, what's a gong farmer? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm going to say he grows the best pipe tobacco in town. And meanwhile, Todd Bunn, the store owner who was playing, just looking it up on his phone, and he goes, oh, it's somebody who cleans out latrines and outhouses, and you've got a bag of poop.
Oh, nice.
Awesome.
I'm like, great. I'm a poopsmith.
Poopsmith. Awesome. All righty. So I guess that'll just, you know, we'll mosey on into some table manners for tonight's requested segment.
Typical. Of all the evil creatures in the world, I'd like to find one with table manners.
And what, are you kidding me? I spent years cultivating the worst table manners on the planet.
Table manners.
All right, folks, here we are in table manners, and we had a request a while back about talking about how to play paladins and about the paladin class. So we're going to cover, you know, how to play a paladin, you know, advice on playing a paladin and lawful good characters, maybe in general, and if there is any other variants of the paladin class. So the kind of kick things off, I think it helps if we kind of define or at least get an idea of what, you know, lawful good is.
Oh, I know.
Oh, you do? Okay. We have someone. Okay. Yes. What do you think?
A lawful good paladin is played like in the movie Gamers 2 Darkness Rising. Sir Osric, right?
Wrong.
Oh.
Wrong. You go to the back of the class. You wear the dunce cap.
No.
Well, here's the... And then in doing some research on this, and I found this rather fascinating, and I mentioned this before we started the show, thank goodness that those... Dragon magazines are available on Archive, because there are some, I found three or four great articles on paladins and lawful good and everything.
Oh.
And so just to kick off kind of as a baseline that everybody knows where we're going at, I'm going to refer to where I, in my opinion, is the best definition of what lawful good is. And I think it's out of the DMG. On page 23, I like the definitions in the DMG more than I like of the player's handbook. And according to the DMG, lawful good are creatures of lawful good alignment view the cosmos, varying degrees of lawfulness and the desire for good. They are convinced that order and law are absolutely necessary to assure good, and that good is best defined as whatever brings the most benefit to the greater number of decent thinking creatures, and the least woe to the rest. So they're people, creatures of lawful good alignment. They want to do what's best for the most people and least harm to everybody else.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Or the one. Thank you, Spock. Yeah. So, but they, and what they also believe is that lawfulness and good are the best things for everyone in the universe, and everybody benefits. If you look at it in a cosmic sort of way. So I like the definition of lawful good in the DMG. I think that best defines it right there. Now, to kind of go on with that, to build upon this, is there was a really good issue of Dragon Magazine, number 38. It was a From the Sorcerer's Scroll with Gary. And there was an article he did called Good Isn't Stupid. Paladins and Rangers and Female Dwarves Do Have Beards. So I'm obviously not going to cover the female dwarves that have beards sort of thing. That's a whole other show entirely. But I'm going to briefly touch on some things in this one article about paladins and rangers, and where I think it's important to talk about when you're using the alignment thing. And what I got out of it is ultimately our perceptions of good, for one, good does not mean stupid. And what Gary says right here, I think is classic. Good does not mean stupid, even if your DM tries to force that concept upon you. Such assertions are themselves asinine, and those who accept such dictates are stupid. So good old Gary. So basically, and I think what he was driving at here is, and we even get to this point in the game, because we're talking around like 81 here, I think 80, 81. A lot of players who played maybe paladins or rangers to a lesser degree because of their alignment restrictions. More so, I think, with paladins, when it comes to alignment, they were defining the lawful goodness of the paladin as they were ignorant oafs who just, you know, hacked anything that was evil in their way, you know, and that's not how a paladin should be portrayed. And that is incorrect. And so people who were essentially playing those paladins wrong. So this is, I think, in this article was one way of Gary saying, you know what, good does not mean that you're stupid.
Right.
And one of the things that he highlighted in the article is not only just where our concepts in the real world of good and evil, law and chaos, there's many varying shifts of, shifting views, and things are defined what our views are of good and evil by age, culture, theology. And all those ideas shift, and there's, like everybody says in the real world, there's varying shades of gray. Well, luckily in the AD&D universe, we don't have to worry about those varying shades of gray if we don't have to. There's defined views of laws, law and chaos, good and evil in AD&D, and which makes it easy for us as players and DMs to know who the good guys and the bad guys are for the most part. So when it comes to AD&D, we don't have to worry about bringing in our real world concepts of good and evil, and it kind of messes things up. And that is one of my pet peeves, because I've seen so many forums where people talk about alignment, and it's one of those, I don't know what it is with gamers, but it's one of those, I think one of those subjects, and that when you talk about them, it seems that people have a way of bringing real world views and concepts into the game world. And I don't personally like that. I like that AD&D, it's an escape. So you want, I want rigidly defined areas of good and evil, law and chaos. So, I mean, that's how I like it. I mean, I don't know how you guys are about it, but I mean,
well, I think
I think it helps with the game.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think a lot of those trying to add in the real world to it is they want the AD&D game world to reflect their own personal worldview. So
right.
when they create their own world in AD&D, they use their beliefs in what is good, what is evil, and
right.
not everyone agrees on that because there are the many shades of gray.
Exactly.
In this, Gary, in the article you're talking about, Gary even put, it is most probable that what is considered good in reality can be good in fantasy. The reverse is not so true. So just,
right.
and you need to keep that in mind. Good is typically universal. Evil, however, isn't.
Not so much. Yeah, exactly. So, and he also goes on in this article, he refers to a sage advice that happened several issues before. And in the, in his answers, he was, what he was in, I guess, in response to what was actually said in the sage advice column, he disagreed what was said in the sage advice column. Ultimately, what Gary was trying to say, and I picked up on this, that in the two instances in the sage advice column where they were talking about, there was a paladin character asked if a character can put someone to death who was severely scarred. So they basically didn't want to live. They wanted to know, would it be okay to put them out of their misery? Okay. Now, according to the sage advice article, the person said, no, you couldn't do that. That would violate paladin. Now, according to Gary, he said, no, not so fast. That might not necessarily be true with the paladin. The one thing being is, what would the paladin's god that he worships, would that be considered an honorable, a good thing, the that person, that character, whoever it is, their misery for their disfigurement? Now, that wasn't brought up in the article, but he said a good DM would bring that up. So,
we'll say it was a dishonored samurai who needed an assistant to perform septicu. Would a paladin be able to do that?
Sure. Absolutely. Even if the person was, maybe this person was, I don't know, if they were so disfigured and maimed, like from a, maybe from a fire. Maybe it was a character that was hit by a fireball and they were so disfigured, their charisma was down to 3 and they couldn't like live anymore. They couldn't live with all the pain and suffering they would have. Gary said, according to Gary, he said, you know, according to whatever god this paladin follows and whatever church it may be, they might allow that sort of thing, to allow a quote unquote mercy killing of this particular character. And there was another one where they talk about maybe a paladin trying to get married and start a family, you know, have a lineage. In the sage advice column, he said, no, that's celibacy, blah, 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 blah. Now, again, Gary, according to Gary, it says, no, not so fast. Maybe according to that paladin's faith, that would be considered okay. In fact, that might be a tenet of their faith. So I think what Gary was driving at here is, ultimately, when you create a paladin and you're going to play a paladin, what's very crucial to the paladin's worldview is whatever faith that he follows. What are the definitions of his faith that are considered good and lawful? And within that faith, what are the tenets of that faith? What do they believe? And would something like like the mercy killing or having a family, are those things acceptable according to that God? So that might be something as a DM you would have to work kind of closely with that player on. Mm-hmm. So do you want to you want to come to some sort of agreement on with the player, right, and have something that they can work with for ultimately, right, so that you enjoy playing the paladin. So
yeah,
and I think that was one of the things he was driving at, yeah, there.
And it's those tenets that could also bring lawful good paladins in conflict with each other, because mm-hmm, because they both have a different priority on what is the ultimate good.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Well, in the movie Excalibur, the first time Arthur meets Lancelot, there's two lawful good paladins who try to half kill each other.
Yeah. Right, because of both of their love for Guinevere.
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking of the bridge that Lancelot and that Arthur crossed. But...
and that too. Oh, yeah. Of course. So that was the one thing in that article, and that was Dragon Magazine 38 that was in. So some of the things, one thing that might help to find the play the paladin character beyond what's in the player's handbook is having whatever god or goddess, could be a female god for all we know, whatever that paladin chooses to follow is, you know, what are the tenets of that faith and how does that fit in with the paladin and how he interacts with his world and how he goes about his adventuring life. Now, to expand on that, to go even further, there was another article by Roger E. Moore in Dragon number 51, and this one, it's called "It's Not Easy Being Good." And he goes on to say, unlike other character classes in AD&D games, the restrictions on the paladin class give it a wealth of special problems in play. No question, there is. I mean, if you look at the player's handbook, like we all know, there are a lot of restrictions as far as what the paladin can and cannot have, but he's also very powerful. Those are trade-offs. I mean, look at the things that he can only have: one suit of armor, one shield, four weapons, and only four other magic items. So he can't hold on to a certain amount of wealth, basically just enough for him to, you know, survive upon. And he doesn't have a normal set of hirelings. He has followers. So, and they have to be lawful good. On the flip side of that, we know in the player's handbook, you got the detect evil, make all saving throws a +2, immunity to all disease, blah, 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 right down the line. We all know that, right? So, you know, with the bad, there's good. I think the good stuff the paladin has in his arsenal far outweighs the bad things. It's the one thing that is the very difficult thing to do is the alignment restriction that everybody seems to have, or I'm not say everybody, but most players have a tough time wrapping their heads around.
Right. The halfling you're torturing has no idea why you suddenly lost your paladin powers.
Yeah. Well, you shouldn't be torturing that halfling in the first place. I almost forgot to mention in the previous article, there was a kind of a quandary thing where he had an example of a tribe of werewolves or something like that, a village of werewolves, and they killed off all the male werewolves, and the only ones left are the women and children werewolves. Now, what a paladin in the party, how would a paladin, what would they do? Should they let them live, or should they kill them?
Kill them. Oh, sorry.
Actually, his answer is kill them.
Yeah.
Reason being is this: they are chaotic and evil creatures. Eventually, those females could reproduce, and the ones that they have will grow up to be either other evil mommy and daddy werewolves. Now, as long as their deaths were swift and painless, the killing of of those other werewolves are justified.
Well, we had that situation just last weekend in my gaming group. We were playing B1. Mm-hmm. You know how there's that room with the little baby goblins?
Yes.
Well, my character killed the baby goblins while the rest of the group was debating on killing the baby goblins.
See?
Right.
Oh.
And then they all got annoyed at me for doing it. And I'm like, why? They're evil. They're going to grow up to be evil no matter what happens. And I'm just making it quick and painless.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And that was in the realms of the game. That was probably the right thing to do. Right.
I'm also a lawful evil character, but anyway.
Right. Well, yeah, it's just like It's just like the kobold nursery in the A series as well.
Exactly. I mean, you have that situation where there's the, what was it, in module A2, I think it was, or A1, you were saying the A series?
Yeah, it was, I think it was later, wasn't it 3 or 4?
Oh, you know what, you're right, it was A3, it was either 3 or 4 where it, no, wait, it was 4, because that's where they're all the player characters are pretty much stripped down the loincloths.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's the last one, the escape from the dungeon of the slave lords. Yeah, they come across the kobolds, and then they have that nursery, and, well, if there's a paladin apart, that's one way to justify it. Now, some people say, well, hold on a second. Well, they're just babies, and they're... That's because you're bringing real-world concepts, real-world quandaries about morality and ethics into a fantasy campaign setting, into a fantasy world.
Well, let's just say that the paladin said, oh, no, we're not going to kill them. We're going to bring them back to society and raise them to be good. You know how much turmoil, you know how much pain they're going to be in because of people always shunning them, throwing things at them. Their life is going to
be causing more harm than good.
Yeah, their life will be so horrible, they're probably going to be turned evil anyway because they're going to resent just about everybody.
Exactly.
Well, I have a question. Mm. You guys, in your various gaming experiences, have you ever seen someone play a paladin well in any of your campaigns?
Actually, yes.
No, not mine.
Yeah, actually.
Yes, I have.
Stupid paladins most of the time.
No.
I have.
Yeah. In my
recent campaign.
Yeah. All right, children, take a number.
Oh, I asked the question because I've never in my entire life seen somebody play a paladin well.
Yeah.
And I understand the challenges involved, which is why I've never stepped up to the plate myself. Plus, I prefer to run wizards, but I've just seen it done poorly. I can tell you all about how not to play a paladin. I even have a theory about this. I'll float this out there for the group.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's just my personal theory. I think probably in real – talk about the difference between the fantasy world and real life. I think in real life maybe 90% of all players at your table are in fact chaotic neutral themselves in real life. And if you're listening to this, I'm not talking about you and your group. I'm talking about everybody else.
Oh,
okay.
No, I think chaotic neutral, chaotic good is probably a way to go in mine.
So that's a challenge right there, because I saw it happen in Tim's campaign where a guy showed up fresh out of 4E, but not a youngster, somebody my age, and you know was jonesing to play a paladin, and he did every classic not playing a paladin correctly. What he wanted to do was be a passive aggressive fighter and take whatever he wanted to do and twist it around and use some sort of lawful good twisted logic to get things to go the way he wanted it to go.
So in other words, he was lawful evil?
He was a serial contrarian.
Okay.
But and I'm sitting there thinking, and we tried everything with this guy. We made him party leader because we figured, okay, he can't argue with group decisions if he's the one making the decisions, and then we'll just follow him along. He's lawful good. How badly could he do? And he immediately figured out a way to turn that around, and I've had very bad experiences with paladins.
Yeah, there can be. In fact, I think I mentioned this once before, but I actually had an experience where my very first AD&D tournament at my very first convention I went to. I think I brought this up. All the player character sheets were on the table, face down, and what did I pick up? I picked up the paladin. In the tournament. And I actually won a prize. I don't know, probably because I was young and foolish and didn't know any better. But I do remember in my recent group, where we're doing the Hackmaster version of Temple of Elemental Evil, and one of the players, he was playing a paladin, and actually there was two paladins in the party. And what happened to him was he played his paladin very well, and he played it by the book. I was really impressed. And he really got into a conundrum where it was a part in the dungeon where his character, they were at the very top level. It was one of the clerics. It was like the fourth or fifth level cleric. He cast a charm person's spell on him, or not charm person, but it was charm person, and he failed to save. My friend's character failed to save, and he told him to. He said attack. He attacked another person in the party, and here's the kicker. He critted him. He critted the other character. He rolled a natural 20 and critted him, almost killed the guy. And because of the definitions of the paladin, what happened to him, he lost his paladinhood.
Ouch.
And he was devastated. I mean, really, really devastated. He role-played it to where he was like, I mean, you could see, man, he had anguish in his eyes. He was just, no, why? Because now he had to go on a quest and all that to regain his paladinhood. But even up to that point, he played the character very well. And I think Jim, you do make a point. Most people have a hard time playing paladins because I don't know, maybe it's just some of the restrictions, but there's also some benefits too. I guess it's just hard to see the benefits of playing that sort of character.
There's some game mechanics involved with it, because the closest I've seen in my gaming history to somebody who played a paladin well, he didn't play him the smartest, but he did pretty good, and he was earnest in his desire to play a paladin, was in one of the very first campaigns, and it worked because maybe eight players with a couple coming in and out, the majority of the players in that group were all lawful good. So it was a lawful good paladin in a lawful good party. I happened to be playing a chaotic neutral fighter mage elf. But they kept me on a leash, and I knew where the line was. There was only so much monkeying around I could do, or I was going to, you know, get the group's wrath. And we went through the A series with that group that you were just talking about. And that at least worked, but it seemed it worked well. But just taking a, you know, lawful good paladin, plunk him down in a random group of assorted alignments seems to bring problems to the situation.
I think one of the things that would help players to play a paladin is one of the things that Gary Gygax alluded to in that Sorcerer's Scroll article, was basically before you even start play as a paladin, you know, whatever god or goddess your paladin worships, it helps to know beforehand, you know, what are the tenets of the faith, what defines that faith, and how does the paladin work that into his everyday, you know, in his everyday life. I think that would help tremendously when people's before they just say, well, I want to play a paladin, I want to do this and this and this with my paladin. Well, it's like, well, hold on a second. Yeah, you get all these cool things to do with the paladin, but you also got to figure out, okay, well, the lack of better term, he is a religious. It is a religious type of character. I mean, he's like, in many ways, a cleric.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a little bit more sword swingy. But I think that would help tremendously if they follow that one step. There's some other things, and like they talk about, like Roger Moore talks about in this other article, help for people, you know, players to, you know, how they can play paladins. And again, he even talks about that, just like in the previous article, that that this is a game and postulates the existence of fundamental absolutes like good and evil, law and chaos. There are few gray areas. So basically saying, throw all your concepts of gray areas in real life out the window if you're going to play a paladin. You have to. Because if you don't, it's going to mess things up for you. You got to get those moral ambiguities out of your head when you're playing a paladin. So, I like to quote this right here. And I think this is a really good passage out of this. And he says, law implies permanence and few changes. And it further implies long-term relationships and love when connected to good. Law also implies obeying the rules of society and working within a system to make things work out for the better. So basically, he's talking about the lawful good ethos in the DMG. Paladins can and should break laws that violate the tenets of lawful good, like slavery and the right to torture prisoners. In basically good societies, though, paladins would be expected to go along with the rules of their church and state, as long as they don't conflict with each other. As in a good DM, though, we know that might happen. But I think that was what he's saying here is like you need to adhere to the ideas of law and good, and also you should, if it need to, you need to break the laws of that society if they do not follow the tenets of lawful good. So, but there are other ways. I think it was interesting in this article where he said there's ways that you can kind of test the faith or test the mettle of the paladin, and basically how he could say, you know, how paladins can get ensnared in chaos and evil. One of them is conceit, being conceited, bordering on hubris, arrogance, hunger for power. So those
basically,
are some
Anakin Skywalker.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, as if you're playing a paladin, you should be humble and you should basically have your actions speak for themselves. I think one of the things that people forget when they play paladins is they think, you know, that everybody, you know, should convert or die, or, you know, they should be loud and say, well, I am such and such and you should bow down before me or I shall slay thee. Well, a paladin's not like that. I think the best paladin, in my opinion, the best paladins who are played are the ones where their actions speak for themselves. They don't boast about what they do. They just, whatever they do as far as furthering lawfulness and good of their god through their actions, you know, actions speak louder than words. That's how they get by in life, and they don't forcefully convert, you know, other, unless part of their faith is, unless that's part of their faith. I mean, it could be, I don't know. But some other things that he talks about, and I've run into this, I think this is a minor thing, is the whole thing with magic items. You know, I think that's one thing that I think as a player you probably just lose track of, you know. I don't think that's a big deal. And I think as, you know, it's like, oh, wait a minute, I'm only supposed to have this. That's fine. I'll give this away. That's cool. So, and that's perfectly fine. That's more or less a bookkeeping thing. I don't know if anybody who I've known who played a paladin where they had more than the magic items they're supposed to have done it maliciously, but I don't know. I just never encountered that. One of the things I kind of disagree upon is, you know, is where the paladins are associating with neutral characters. I don't necessarily see this as a particularly bad thing. You know what I mean? I mean, you guys might see it differently. I mean, as long as the party isn't predominantly neutral, I don't see a problem with that. I mean, what do you think?
As far as associating with evil people?
No, neutrals.
Oh, neutral. I don't see a problem with that as well.
I don't see either. I know they're supposed to be some sort of, you know, there's a kind of a restriction that, according to the player's handbook, they can associate with neutral characters on a one-time basis. You know,
I always waive that.
I kind of overlook that. I mean, unless they're like a true neutral, maybe, but you know, like neutral good, you know, lawful neutral. I kind of let that slide. Chaotic neutral, that's kind of weird. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I've also gotten away with being evil in a group with the paladin. So
as long, and I was kind of getting that, as long as the paladin is not aware,
yeah,
that just, the player character is evil.
Just don't do anything evil around him, and he won't realize that you're an evil character.
Love that in Order of the Stick, when they were with the paladins, and every time the paladin used his detect evil, which Rich Berlew did, is like X-ray vision coming out from his eyes. Belcar would just hold up a sheet of lead.
Yeah, that's right.
That's great. The problem, though, is once the paladin is aware that there's evil in the party, he just can't turn away from it.
Well, that's understandable, yeah.
So he's going to have to do something about it. And whatever that may be, that, again, is defined by the tenets of the paladin's faith. It's not necessarily converting by the sword. It could be some sort of like, would you like to repent from your ways of evil? It could be something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, again, everybody assumes that, you know, if there's an evil player in a character in the party, that the person who's playing the paladin is going to go in and kill that other player character. Not necessarily so.
Well, evil is a different thing, but a intelligent, lawful, good paladin could explain to chaotic and neutral characters how it's in their own best interest to toe the line. Because being chaotic doesn't mean you have to be chaotic if it's in your own best interest.
They say, well, if this is towards the greater good of the whole, then, you know, maybe that, like you said, that it's towards the greater good of the party or maybe society as a whole. I think another way, again, is maybe it's like maybe the person playing the paladin is, I'm going to lead by my actions to where this person who's playing that's evil, maybe my actions will show them a better way. Maybe that's one way they could do, they could, you know, maybe somehow get that character from being evil. You know, I'm just throwing that out there as an idea. So maybe that's kind of a passive aggressive way. I don't know. But, and one other thing that I thought that was brought up in this article is interesting is killing.
Mm-hmm.
And right off the bat, it says killing is a difficult topic to address when regards to paladins. No kidding, really.
Really?
Now, one of the things he brings up is like undead of any sort, evil dragons, and all demons, devils, and daemons deserve no other fate than utter and absolute destruction. I will go along with that. Absolutely. Sparing them is evil. So, and he also goes on the same beings like beholders and mind flayers pretty much fit into that category as well. So, orcs, trolls, the same also applies to them. They are evil, and they're evil. There are evil deities and make a living in keeping them evil, and there's not much more to say. So,
that's exactly how I've seen the class misplayed over and over again. Is okay, we have to talk to the monster first and try and see if it'll surrender when it's a giant sand cat with, you know, that's been picking your party off every night. You're guarding the caravan. Right. No, you don't have to talk to it. Kill it.
Right, exactly. With a paladin, there's no question. It is a creature that, like what we're going to talk about next. Well, I won't go into that. Well, ogres. We're going to talk about ogres.
Oh, Nick.
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, if there was like a tribe of ogres and orcs, do you think a paladin's going to try to say, you know, walk into the village of ogres and orcs and say, have you learned about have you considered turning your faith toward those of blah, blah, blah? No. He's going to find out the best way to destroy that village, and so the evil will not spread. basically he's looking at, he's not, he's looking at, you know, killing those evil creatures because they are in the game world and the concepts of law and chaos and good and evil, they are evil. You know, just like Middle Earth orcs are evil to the core. There's no converting them. You know, they are, and yes, they do have pig faces. So, you know, and this is where, again, where other, maybe other people, when they play, when I talked about before, this is where they get into those moral ambiguities that they bring from the real world. It's like, well, is it really justifiable to go into their village and to slay every one of them, every female and child and of these orcs and ogres? In the game world, yes, it is.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. You know, that's just how it is.
Yeah, we actually had a situation in my home group that I was playing a monk, and a friend of mine was playing a paladin. We were attacked by a group of dire wolves. We fought off the wolves, and one of the wolves fled. As it was fleeing, the paladin slayed it. At which point, my monk was, they were just doing what they were bred, what they were created to do. You should have let it go. It was no harm to us. And he was like, no, this was, these wolves would cause damage to others as well, perhaps those that couldn't defend themselves.
And they're dire wolves. They're evil.
Right. Uh-huh. So at that, but the neutral monk would be, the battle is over. It's no threat to us. Okay, let it go. Paladin, no, it's a threat to others, so it must be stopped now.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
So you can end up with that type of interplay in a group, and it's okay if you have the right players.
That, and you know what? That stuff is okay because in a larger sense, that kind of creates a little bit of group tension, but that's a good thing.
Right. Having
that makes good role playing.
Right. You can tell interesting stories with group conflict as long as the group conflict doesn't become the focus of the story.
Well, right. So much of it depends on the players. In our old campaign, I got tasked with taking over a lawful, evil, anti-paladin NPC. And I played that guy for like 6 months and managed to play the character right without killing anybody in my party or screwing any of the other players over.
Right.
It can be done.
Yeah.
Probably because you're looking at it, how is it, can I manipulate the rest of the party for my own benefit?
Well, I was given a task to accomplish by the DM that didn't involve directly, you know, doing any of that stuff. So I was able to, you know, still show up and play, and they had no idea I was an anti-paladin.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool. So,
more concerned for the campaign as a whole than for what's going on with my individual character.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And the last thing is, he talks about, I'm not even going to talk about poison. I'm not even going to have to worry about that because we know they can't use poison. The last thing I saw this article is, what really do they believe? What do paladins actually believe in their faith and their worldview? They believe in friendships. They believe in law and order, charity, sharing personal dedication to high goals and standards, chains of command, obedience to others, honesty and truth, and taking joy in being alive. Paladins would define more allies of lawful good alignment and establish assurances of mutual aid in case of danger to one another. Permanence, tradition, and predictability are pursued. So basically, they're like really good soldiers. They believe in honor. They believe in chain of command. They believe in obedience. But they believe in also, you know, fellowship, friendship, law and order. That's the meat and potatoes of being a paladin. And I think those things in that article, and I hope we can post a link to these articles, and that's in issue 51 of Dragon magazine, is
we can always link it up via
We'll link it up.
Yeah.
And there was one other article I found that's really good. And by a fellow by the name of Robert J. Beazold, in the same magazine, right next article, is like the 10 commandments for paladins. Basically, he took the 11th century oath that knights took when they went on crusades and put it into an AD&D game world sort of thing. And the first one goes, thou shalt accept the counsels of thy mentor and obey all his commandments. And there's all 10 of these, and we can link this up. But really what it gets down to in this article is not only when you start play as a paladin and define what God that he is following and what are the tenets of that faith is, but also that paladin should have some sort of mentor that he reports to, that he follows. And the suggestion is that it should be like a cleric of at least 10th level, basically a head of a church or some temple somewhere where this paladin gets his orders, where his mentor is. So I think that's another good thing to have when you're starting to play a paladin, is you should have a higher mentor that you need to report to. I don't know why, but it just sounded like a really good idea, that basically he is the mentor is your counselor, and maybe not only counselor, but your confessioner as well. So, and there's several of these commandments kind of fall into that. There's some other ones. Thou shalt not recoil before thine enemy. So basically, don't turn away from evil. Thou shalt make war against evil without cessation and without mercy. And it goes on and on. There's all these other kind of commandments for maybe a paladin to follow. I think this is just one way of looking at, maybe not the best way, but it could be something that you can use in your game world when it comes to a paladin and playing them, at least a lawful good paladin. So, but there are other types.
Mm-hmm.
There are other types of paladins. Well, one of them, obviously, is the
Cavalier
Paladin. No, the Anti-Paladin.
I always hated the Anti-Paladin class because I just thought it was just ridiculous. A complete opposite paladin. I prefer paladins to be based on their god alignment-wise.
Right, and that's why the Anti-Paladin, when it was first came out in Dragon Magazine, that it was an NPC.
Well, of course, when I was a young kid, like 13, 12, around there looking at Anti-Paladin, going, oh, this is the coolest thing in the world. Now I look at it, it's the most stupidest thing in the world.
It can be, because it was never meant to be a player character. It's a non-player character class.
Yeah,
it should be.
And in fact, all the other ones that I will briefly touch on that were in a Dragon Magazine article, they're all recommended to be non-player character classes. And after reading through them all, I could see why. Because if you think playing a regular paladin that's lawful good is tough to play, try playing one of these. It's virtually impossible. I mean, really, the Anti-Paladin, and you can find it either in Best of Dragon Volume 2 if you have it, or I think July 1980, Dragon number 39.
Okay.
You could find the original article on the Anti-Paladin. It was made to be the nemesis for a party. It was to be the evil big bad dude at the end of the dungeon. That's who it is. If
like the Venger of the D&D cartoon.
In a sense, yeah, I guess you can call it like that. To kind of put a face to it, you could maybe use that. I kind of look at the Anti-Paladin as someone who is not only a nemesis to a paladin and to a party as a whole, but also furthering the ethos of chaos and evil. So he's probably following an evil, chaotic evil god, or probably more than likely, in my opinion, he would be a worshiper of a demon. You know, probably worships what's one of the demons out there?
Demogorgon, Orcus.
Demogorgon, yeah, or Orcus. There you go. So that's how I always saw a paladin, the Anti-Paladin. And they can do pretty much anything a paladin can't. You know, they can use poison. They can they get a backstab ability, protection from good, all of that stuff. They're followers. You know, they could be either humans, you know, but the Volors are either brigands, thieves, assassins. They can have goblins, hobgoblins, ogres, gnolls. And if you roll on the special, you could have, you know, undead follow you, except vampires or liches.
What do you think, Nick, of an example putting a face on the anti-paladin of Cain, of the Legend of Cain?
That would be interesting. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
I think that would be good. That would be a definitely cool way to go.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the anti-paladin as someone who's, like I said, who's following some chaotic evil god or demon, and they are, you know, trying to spread evil and chaos throughout the world as much as they can. So
there's a anti-paladin character in my comic, and they were all drawing cards from the deck of many things, and he just got impatient with his and chopped it in two. So Death shows up, and and they're all standing back, and the anti-paladin and Death just fist bump and agree to go down to the village and drown some halflings.
Nice.
That's a very anti-paladin thing to do. So, yeah, the anti-paladin is really nasty. I thought one of the interesting things about the anti-paladin is they're either their charisma is very high or very low. Did you see that in the article in the original anti-paladin? Their charisma is either 3 or 4 or 17 or 18.
So all they have to do is take their helmet off and say versus fear.
Yeah, basically, when you create the anti-paladin's charisma, you roll a d4. A 1 equals a charisma of 3. A 2 corresponds to a charisma of 4. A 3 equals a charisma of 17. And a 4 is an 18. So either you're incredibly ugly, demonic-looking probably, or he looks like, I don't know, he's got, how they define it in the article, like he might have like a well-waxed black mustache and slicked back hair. And you know, he's really suave looking. So he could look either way when you create him. It doesn't change. It's just like either the one that you create is either incredibly ugly or he's incredibly good looking. So,
well, don't forget, charisma is not exactly the way they look. It's the way they're perceived. So,
well, that too. Yeah, if you throw in the whole comeliness thing, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So,
I've been learning to use that a lot lately because it's kind of interesting now that I've used dynamic in my games.
Yeah, I like using the separate comeliness stat too. I do. So, as far as anything else on the anti-paladin, they're... Really, as far as playing them, again, this is a non-player character class. This is something you cannot play in a party unless you really want to play an all-evil party. I think the anti-paladin would just go in and take everybody over anyway. So, the way to play him is, like, he's the nemesis to the party, as like it said in the article. So... however you want to use that in your game world, how he is a nemesis, that's entirely up to you as a DM. Now, there are other types of, I guess, paladins that you can play for all the other different alignments. And that was in Dragon 106 and by a fellow by the name of Christopher Wood. And he made up a whole bunch of different paladins for the different alignments, and again, these are all non-player characters, and I could get in all the details on them, but it would take forever. It's a very long article. But the different ones, you have one called the Merikian. He's for neutral good. The Garath for chaotic good. The Lion for lawful neutral. The Paramander for neutral. Fantra for chaotic neutral. Chaotic neutral paladin. Yeah, isn't that wild? The Illrigger for lawful evil, and the Erakon for neutral evil. And they each have different hit dice. They have different special abilities. Some of them, just to kind of touch on this, like the the one for chaotic neutral and neutral good. The paladins, they can only wear up to chainmail quality armor.
Right. And then the chaotic neutral one can only use a wooden shield.
Wooden shield. Because I guess the idea behind the chaotic neutral paladin, the Fantra, I want to say Fanta like the soda, yeah, but it's orange flavored Fantra. but the chaotic, they're like nomads, they're wanderers, so they have to move as lightly as possible. That's why they only have wooden shields. And they only can wear up the chainmail armor. I guess that's one of the things behind the concepts behind them. Also, the different classes, they have different ability score minimum and maximums. Some of them actually put a more emphasis maybe on wisdom or intelligence more so than strength. So it really depends. So I would just refer to that article. And that's in Dragon Magazine 106, A Plethora of Paladins,
yeah,
and all the different, you know, types that there are. And obviously the anti-paladin kind of falls into that as right. well.
Yeah, I actually find it interesting just for the neutral version, it actually has a cap on the wisdom. You can
wisdom.
If you're too wise, you cannot be a neutral paladin.
Yeah, was it the Paramander?
Paramander, yeah. Yeah.
The Paramander, he can only have a maximum wisdom of 16.
Well, yeah, that's still pretty wise.
Right. Yeah. But if you're a 17, 18, are you too wise and realize that true neutral is silly? Or I'm just curious what the reasoning behind that was.
Some of them have maximum limits on intelligence and charisma that I noticed.
Yeah.
Or dex, like the Lyan, it's for lawful neutral paladins. They have a maximum intelligence of 16 and a maximum charisma of 16.
And then a maximum dex is 16 as well.
Yeah. So, but their minimum strength is 12. So they're, again, another trade-off.
Yeah.
The Paramander, like you were talking before, the minimum intelligence per Paramander is 14. Some of these other ones, they also get magic user spells and not just cleric spells. I think the Paramander is one of them. Mm-hmm. That they get different types of special abilities. Not all of these paladins can turn undead. So, I recommend, taking a look at that. If that's something that you think would fit into your game world, and having a plethora of different paladins for you to have, like a plethora of piñatas, señor.
Yeah.
Would you say I have a plethora? See, what is a plethora? So, ultimately, I don't know. As far as playing a paladin, I think the two things that I got out of doing all the research and everything three. One, take all of your concepts of moral ambiguity and throw them out the window before you begin playing a paladin. Whatever real world concepts you have, just get them out of the way. Two, I think it helps to define whatever god that your paladin follows. What is the tenets of the faith? What is the ethos? And how does that work into the game world? And I think you should work that closely with the DM, so both of you are on the same playing field. And the third thing is, I like the concept of having the mentor of like having of at least a 10th level cleric. That when you have your paladin when he first starts play, it's someone that he confides in, someone that he gets his orders from, somebody he, I guess, reports back to. Another way, it's exactly a perfect place because that cleric is going to be attached to a temple. That's going to be a perfect way for him to donate any monies, any magic items too. So I think those three concepts would be really good in helping people play paladins better.
And if you master it and can play a paladin well, please come to CincyCon or GaryCon and play one in front of me so I can applaud you.
Or Origins. I'll be there at Origins if I could see someone play a paladin well. Because, yeah, it's even up to today in 2013, it's hard to find people play paladins well. But I think if some of those guidelines are followed, you know what? The payoff is great. I'm actually really jazzed for my next character when I get into another campaign. I want to play a paladin. I want to see if I could really do it well.
A jacked up 10th or 12th level paladin can take a magic user right out.
Yeah.
No problem.
And I just –
Is it 9th level they get any magic shell basically?
Yeah. I like the idea that, you know, there is such a great role-playing challenge to them. I look at the restrictions, not just the restrictions. I look at them as challenges for role-playing. If you could take that and make that part of your character, I think that's just a really cool way to go. So any other ideas, concepts, suggestions, or have I babbled on long enough?
Wow, you've done a wonderful job babbling.
Thank you. Yes. I really enjoyed looking up all this stuff about paladins, and we will post links to those Dragon magazines in our notes, so everybody can look all that stuff up and hopefully improve their play on paladins.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah,
I think
maybe
it sounds
awesome. All paladins should have blunt weapons.
No,
okay.
Absolutely not. That would take the Holy Avenger sword right out of the equation. Thank you very much. And that would not be nice. So that's all I got to say about that.
Christopher Walken voice.
So, paladins, holy swords, killing evil ogres and stuff. Wow.
That's awesome.
Sounds good to me.
So yeah, that's paladins, and hopefully we gave some help to some folks.
Hopefully the request was done as we done it for them.
I think so.
I don't know. So let's head into our next segment of the creature feature.
Are you saying that I put an abnormal brain into a 7.5-foot long gorilla?
Creature Feature Theater.
It's alive! It's alive!
And now we head to the Creature Feature Theater, and this was another request, and we are going to talk about, as Nick alluded to earlier, the ogre.
I have a +9 knife against ogres!
Yeah. Or is originally typed O-R-G-E-S.
Yes. Yes. Ogres, which actually, considering ogres are actually French in origin, that's kind of appropriate.
Yeah, I guess.
I was thinking that was the Brazilian version, orgues.
Orgues.
Put the little French sauce on. Oh, never.
Well, that's what the ogres would do to your children, since, yes, they tend to be cannibalistic.
Hey, Shrek never ate children.
Well, Shrek is like Driss. He's the exception.
Okay, good.
Roast halfling. You should try it with a little twisty lemon. It's good.
Yeah, because in the
onions have layers. Onions have layers.
Yeah, because they do like to take prisoners, and it actually says 25% will be taken for slaves, 75% taken for food.
Hey, everybody's got to eat.
Exactly. But yes, ogres, they are like the lesser of the giant humanoids, considering I would put giants ahead of them as being fearful. Ogres are kind of the large humanoids that are kind of dumb. They're usually used as mercenaries or the guards because they are intimidating, but really they're not going to be masterminding any great plots. They're basically large orcs in that extent.
They're like the muscle for the hitman.
Yeah.
So they're like, you know, they're like the guy like, you know, Louis Four Fingers, Joey Bag of Donuts.
Right.
Well, they're stupid and they're chaotic evil, so they need bossing around.
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go.
Right. Yeah, because they're just 4 hit die plus 1. They can do 1d10 if they punch you, or they'll damage you with their weapon.
And then
they're good, big, bad for a low level group.
Right.
Yeah, I was just going to say they're usually the first big nasty thing out like a group of first or second level characters.
Sort of a segue before they're ready to start taking on giants.
Exactly. Yeah. They're little mini giants, if you will.
Mini giants?
Mini giants.
It's like jumbo shrimp.
Exactly. Yeah. And the great thing about ogres, you can find them anywhere. You can just plop them in any terrain, in dungeons. It doesn't matter. They fit. They're ugly, ill-tempered, and ferocious. They also like treasure, so it's great for those first-level parties that are looking to get some stuff, too.
You said ugly and ill-tempered, so and the French thing.
Well,
now
action.
They also will mingle with trolls and some giants, and sometimes demons will make them their slaves. So
yeah, I thought that was cool too. I missed that.
Right,
and gnolls, which I don't get.
Because I could just see the ogres looking down at the gnoll, be like, "Why is this doggy trying to tell me what to do?" But
ruff,
ruff, ruff. And then if you run across 11 or more ogres, that's when you get the leader who has 7 hit dice.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And then if there's more than 16, you get 2 leaders and an additional chieftain. And so they actually do have their own little social structure.
2 leaders? Like a soda? Or
Well, if only they had 3 leaders, and then they could be the Jolt Cola of the Monster Manual.
That's right.
Yes. And then if you come across their lair, this is where the paladin could start telling the party why it's okay to slaughter the women and children. Because if you find
their ogres.
Exactly. If you find their lair, there will be 2 to 12 females who will fight. And then there will also be 2 to 8 young. And they will fight as goblins. So every time you kill a goblin, it's like you're killing a baby. Or every time you fight an ogre, it's like you're killing a baby goblin or a regular full-size goblin.
Every time you kill a baby ogre, it's like killing a goblin.
Yes. And then it also says...
Okay, orcs with pig faces. And now we got...
Baby ogres with goblin faces.
Baby ogres are like goblins. Yeah. So are goblins like baby ogres?
Apparently. And now I've got a vision of like the abominable...
Maybe goblins are baby ogres.
Maybe. I now have a vision of the abominable snow monster from Looney Tunes when he's holding Bugs. and just do it, and an ogre doing that with a goblin. I love you. I'm going to hug you and squeeze you and comb your hair.
I'm gonna hug you and squeeze you and call
maybe
you
a baby
George.
Goblin. No, baby
George
ogre.
Is my friend.
Baby ogre as a goblin with a blunt weapon.
Yes, because they're not old enough for the sharp pointy spears yet.
That's
yes,
right. And their god doesn't allow it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And what else about ogres there, Matt?
Yeah, they're also fond of halflings, dwarves, and elf flesh. And there's only a 10% chance that such a creature will be found alive in their lair. So, yeah, if you're captured by an ogre and you're one of those races, you are what's for dinner.
No, so halflings are like chicken McNuggets to these guys.
Exactly. They're a delicacy.
Hmm. And unfortunately, they do not turn to stone in sunlight.
So.
Though they speak stone giant, I saw.
Right. Orc, troll, stone giant, and, of course, the alignment language of chaotic evil. And then, so, yeah, they're just a nice...
Those of us use alignment languages, which I don't.
Yeah. But if you had that anti-paladin, they could have all kinds of little nonverbal communication with each other, and no one would ever know.
I don't know. I want to picture that. Ew. What are they doing? Oh my god! That's just disgusting.
No, it's okay.
They're speaking chaotic evil to each other. Well, if that's what chaotic evil speech is, I don't want to see it.
Right. At that point, that's when the Anti-Paladin would have already have said, I'm selling off the dwarf and gnome, so you can just eat them, let me go. But yeah, they make a nice little scary monster for the low-level party, but not so scary that they're going to die.
And, what about their oriental counterpart?
Oh, yes, the Ogre Magi. And then the offshoot, the Oni, as we discussed in when we talked about Oriental Adventures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Oni. Oni's are interesting little monsters to use. Well, not little, but they're interesting monsters to use.
Yeah, then they're much scarier than their typical ogre counterparts. Since the Ogre Magi will always have the great a chief with great strengths, so he gets +2 to each hit die, and then attacks as a 9-hit die monster. A normal ogre is only a 4-hit die monster. Then they also can perform the following feats of fly, become invisible, cause darkness, polymorph to human, and they also regenerate 1 hit point per melee round.
And once per day, they can do what?
Charm, sleep, assume gaseous form, and create a ray of cold in the same dimensions as that of the cold wand.
Yeah, I got a little story about an ogre mage that did something like that. Way, way a while ago, when we were first playing our Hackmaster campaign, there was, when they got into the Giants series, the Hackmaster version against the Giants, Annihilate the Giants, there was an ogre mage.
Oh.
And I called him Master Pain. Master Pain.
Master Pain.
The Ogre Mage. Knew Kung Fu. And he would do Kung Fu things and then do his Cone of Cold. He was Master Pain. How many of you know where I got the name from?
I'm going for the movie Major Pain?
No. Don't you remember?
China.
No. The one Kung Fu spoof, Enter the Fist.
Oh, yeah. Huh?
There was the one character's name was Master Pain.
I figured since there was a beholder in Big Trouble in Little China, I had a good shot.
Well, you were wrong. Anyway, but yeah, the Cone of Cold, very nasty effect from the Ogre Mage. Let me tell you. Eight hit dice Cone of Cold coming at a bunch of people the way they have no place to go, stuck on a stairwell.
Yeah. Evil?
Yeah, thank you.
Lawful evil, that is. So they're not the...
they are lawful evil.
Yeah, they're lawful evil, not chaotic evil. So they have a very an actual organized structure to their existence, as opposed to just, we go to the local village and eat all the demi-humans. Which there's actually no reference to them being cannibals.
No.
Either.
Yeah, if I remember correctly... Wasn't it Module S2, White Plume Mountain, the Nemesis was an Ogre Mage?
Think so.
I'm pretty sure it was the halfling or the gnome that they encounter at the end. And he's actually a polymorphed Ogre Mage.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a surprise.
Yeah. Let's see. Ogre Magi actually... foray to capture treasure and humans for slaves and food. So they prefer humans. Whereas they're...
Which is where you get half ogres.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And there was actually two articles in Dragon Magazine talking about...
Number 29 and number 73.
Yes. Gary Gygax wrote in his column about... creating the half ogre as a player race, and he basically, you can tell he doesn't really like the concept.
He spends 2/3 of the article telling you don't do this.
Right. This is bad. Your players are trying to break the game. No. Bad. No. Then he's like,
well, here's the stats.
Right. Here's the stats if you really want to, but I wouldn't do it. Because he was like, what's next? Dwarf elf? Dwarf gnome? Dwarf halfling? Elf gnome? Elf halfling?
Oyster? Yeah. Get it?
A half-halfling, a quartling.
Right. So, yeah, he pretty much just says, don't do this. Your players are trying to break the game. If you want stats to do it, here you go. But, and then the second article, though, by Roger Moore, the whole half-ogre actually fleshes out what Gary wrote and actually gives you something a little more playable. Mm-hmm. because in that he actually will give you the he gives you the stats, like the strength will be between 14 and 18, intelligence between 3 and 12, wisdom 2 and 12, dexterity 3 and 12, constitution 14, 18, charisma 2 and 8. And you actually make a roll to determine if the human parent is below norm for several all the categories other than because that it skews the stats there. And it also gives them the following special that it doesn't really mention in the monster manual, infravision. And it gives them, yeah. And then it also, you get two hit dice at beginning level. And then every level after that, you progress as normally as your class.
And what classes are they available? I know fighter is one.
It was fighter. And it was cleric.
Cleric, even though with the wisdom restriction. Interesting.
Right. However, they have a level limit of 4 for cleric.
For cleric.
So
I would even revise that, at least in my game world, because I allow half-ogres as a player race, but I allow them also to be barbarians. Yeah. I think it kind of makes sense. Even half-orcs, too.
Well, considering when these articles were written, that was pre-Unearthed Arcana, so yeah, I wouldn't have a problem with that either, because I think barbarian would actually fit them rather well.
I thought so, too, and for half-orcs. Right. I thought the barbarian class would fit rather well with them. Right.
And when you look at half-ogres, really, from the description in the Roger Moore article, their height ranges from 7 to 8 feet, and they weigh between 315 to 425 pounds. I mean, really, they're more human in just human appearance than ogre.
They're really big defensive linemen.
It's like – actually, Vince will get this reference. They're the Great Khali.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay.
Right. It's like they have agromegaly. I mean, that's –
King Kong Bundy?
No, he was more round.
The Giant Gonzalez?
Yes, Giant Gonzalez. Even Andre the Giant.
Andre the Giant. There you go.
Right. What was his character's name in Princess Bride?
Fezzik.
Fezzik, yes. Fezzik. You could say he was a half-ogre if you wanted.
Fezzik. Jog his memory.
He was about the right height.
Right. So he was the right height, the right size, and it says skin color and hair color are variable, but it tends to be brown, grayish brown, black, dull yellow, and skin hue the same. So it's perfect.
So he was a half ogre.
Yeah.
I'll be damned. And he was French too.
Yeah? Huh. Okay, it explains so much.
That plays a lot.
But yeah.
But from my understanding, he was a really nice guy in real life.
Yeah. The wrestling promotion I work for in Cincinnati, the guy that runs it refereed for the WWF between like 1983 and 2005.
You said F.
I said F because he worked there when they had an F.
Get the F out.
From his little bit of mingling with Andre was a nice guy, but he was also one of those who just can be moody at times just because he just kind of wanted to be left alone and people would never leave him alone.
He liked to drink beer and play cards.
Right. There was one instance where he drank so much he passed out on the floor of a hotel room, a hotel lobby, and no one could move him. He was too big. So they threw a carpet.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah. And to solve this problem, until he woke up, the hotel threw a carpet over him.
So, role-playing hints to playing a half-ogre.
Yeah. Throw a carpet on him.
Yeah.
Get Hulk Hogan to move them.
Yeah. But as for just role-playing them, though, I mean, if you play them by the book, you're going to have problems in your party, like Gary talks about. If you play them, especially if you emphasize their ogre nature, because then you're going to want to go eat people in dwarves and elves. And I don't think the rest of your party will like that.
Gnomes?
Yeah, why not gnomes? Why don't they eat gnomes?
Because they're usually in the garden scaring people away.
Not enough meat on the bone.
No. Mm-hmm. No.
A little too gamey.
Right.
What I love about that Gary Gygax article in Dragon 29 is, because I just reread it today, and it shows you how dead serious he was about maintaining game balance. I've learned anecdotally a lot of that through Tim Kask, where Tim has sort of told me stories of, you know, why the demi-humans had level limits in OD&D and all this stuff. And Gary was very obsessed with, okay, this is the balance I want, and this is the balance we maintain.
Huh.
Right.
And that article about the ogres, because it's more almost an article on how to game balance new player races.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then I just saw this line in the Gary Gygax article. Pixie Storm Giant half-breeds would be impossible. For those who doubt the claim, consider us a lecherous male pixie equipped with several growth potions and a love flit tree, and when all is said and done, AD&D is fantasy.
What are you snarfing at, Nick? Isn't there pixies in Hackmaster?
Yeah, there's pixie fairies, but not pixie fairy storm giant half breeds.
Why not? There could be.
According to this, it would not be impossible.
Ha!
But just wrong.
Exactly, and that's actually what the half of the article was, just talking about how wrong all of this would be
Not wrong on principle, but wrong on the basis that this is players seeking an unfair advantage, trying to break your game.
Right. Yeah.
And hence all the restrictions the half ogre has.
Right. Yeah.
But have you guys? And again, that might be role playing opportunities.
Have you done any half breed class? Races before, other than the half orc?
No.
Well, yeah, half ogre.
Okay.
I know in Hackmaster they have gnomelings. Gnome halfling crossbreeds.
Well, I had some players go as far as when they played like a half elf or a half ogre or a half orc. They went as far as saying they were 3/4 this or 3/4 that. And he was serious about it. He wrote up a whole backstory how he was that way. How he was saying his mother was 1/4 this and his father was 3/4 that, and he made 1/4 of this, and he actually wrote it out, so I let him play it because it was, you know, he takes the time to do it. I'm not going to say no.
Yeah. I mean, if it works within gameplay and not like not just advantages, but there are some disadvantages too.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain point. I mean, in real life, I'm 1/16th Cherokee, and if you saw me in person, you can't see any Cherokee in me.
Right. Well, there you go.
Right. I see. All right, so I think we've beaten the ogres down. And we should probably head into the treasure chest.
You have opened the treasure chest. You may choose an item.
Opening up the treasure chest this week, we reach inside and we get a cursed shield. Negative.
No!
A missile attractor. If you head over to the DM guide, page 165. And this is a pretty nifty item to throw on your party. And I always love that Gary threw these things in the book. The missile attractor not only makes the bearer equivalent to a shieldless person, it also attracts missiles of all sorts. So it doubles or treble? Treble? I usually say treble. I've never said that way. But the bearer's chances of being selected by a random die rolling according to the size of the party he or she is in. This cursed shield is not distinguishable from any other useful magical shield. So I've used this quite a few times in my group, and they've picked up this shield, seeing it on, like, I had it situated, two hobgoblins were guarding it, and it was situated on a stone in the back of the room, and they figured that they were guarding it for, you know, because it was treasure, but they really weren't. They were kind of treep other creatures away from it. So they killed them, and they were like, oh, they all fought over, and they grabbed the shield, and they thought it was a cool shield, because I described it as a really cool magical shield, and mm-hmm. In battle, he started to notice that the arrows always hit him more than everybody else. And then he thought it was just me picking on him at first. And then he's like, you know what? I changed my shield out. I said, sure. He takes the curse shield and throws it on the ground and picks up his other shield he has slung on his back. And I'm like, fine. And then all of a sudden, someone shoots an arrow and the arrow hits him in the back. And he's like, what the heck? And I was just like, oh, and as you're pulling the arrow out of your back, you notice there's a shield stuck to your back right now. Oh, look at that. It's the shield you just threw on the ground. And it was one of those, you know, cartoon things when someone throws it, just kind of loops back and kind of like an army of
death. That answers my questions. Like, your cursed items, you can't get rid of them.
Oh, no.
Unless, like, wish or remove curse.
Like when Bruce Campbell threw the book of Necronomicon and came flying back towards him and everything.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
This shield actually showed up in our campaign, and that's exactly the way our DM ran it. The poor fighter that got stuck with it, I mean, he dropped it off a cliff, he dropped it down a well, and it would just reappear in his on his arm every time he did that, like next round. And that guy was so smart, he turned it into like Captain America's shield. He's like, okay, it's a tracking missile, so he would come into before he would get into melee, when he was at ranged, he'd throw the shield at like the orcs and let it attract the missiles towards them. And it would sometimes he had pretty good dex. Sometimes it would hit an orc and do damage, and the next round he had it back.
Awesome.
Wow. He screwed our DM over big time with that.
That is amazing. Yeah. That's smart playing.
Yep. Our DM allowed it because it was so smart.
Right.
That is so smart. That's brilliant.
Yeah. It was like I was almost thinking, what if you knew it was if before you picked it up, you knew it was cursed. So you put it, you were to rig it on like a cart and push the cart in front of you. So that way the volley of arrows all go to that shield.
Now, what if a player did this? How about this situation? A player has a cursed shield. They know it's cursed. They can't get rid of it right now because they have nobody to uncurse them. And now the shield must stay with them. What if they plunge it into the ground right in front of them and attract the missiles down to the ground in front of them instead of them directly? Do you think, would you allow that or no?
Well, it doesn't – it attracts the missiles towards the player, not necessarily the shield. I think that's the key.
Because according to it, it says like your armor class is if without the shield. Right. I would almost rule it as like the arrows like magically go through the shield and into the player character.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just curious what you guys thought about that.
The way this DM ran it, the guy was taking the arrow hits every other round when the shield would come back.
Nice. Well, tell us what you think about these things we spoke about today by emailing us at rfistaff@gmail.com, or you can call us at 570-865-4210, the hotline, where we're always standing by to take your message. And, Jim, how can people get a hold of you if they want to contact you or visit Marvin the Mage?
Marvin the Mage is either at marvinthemage.com or mudpuppycomics.com. There's email on there. It's marvinthemage@marvinthemage.com, and also through Gygax Magazine. In case anybody's interested in submitting any art or articles, it's jwampler@gygaxmagazine.com. And if you forget all that while you're listening to us talk, just go to the Gygax Magazine website.
Gygaxmagazine.com, I believe it is, yes.
Yes.
Cool. Well, I guess that's going to wrap the show up.
Aww.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh. Sure, we don't want you back. Oh. I mean, no, we do. No, I'm kidding. We love you.
Yeah.
We appreciate you stopping by, and good luck on your future endeavors. No, I'm kidding.
Here's a nice parting gift. It's a minus one shield cursed.
Here you go.
There are days when I feel like I have that shield.
And you can listen to Jim on Save or Die as he'll be transitioning over towards them as a
regular host. Yeah. Sweet.
In about 60 seconds, I'm going to go do that.
Wow. Wow, that's quick.
Yep. Well, so we'll let Jim go. So we'll keep it original, keep it old school, and good night, everybody.
Good night.
Night, everyone.
Night.
Roll for initiative.